Available on listener-sponsored WBAI New York. Thank you so much for listening.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program, the greatest evil is war. We're joined by Pulitzer Prize winner Chris Hedges. That's the title of his latest book, just out. His new book is an unflinching indictment of the horror and obscenity of war by one of our finest war correspondents. Later in the program, we're joined once again by Professor Peter Kuznick, historian from American University, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Kuznick joins the program to talk about the recently deceased Mikhail Gorbachev and his struggles to achieve peace in a world of war. Today on the Project Censored Show, an hour, The Greatest Evil is War, with Chris Hedges and Peter Kuznick. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies like an ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program, in the first segment, we are honored to welcome Chris Hedges. Hedges, no stranger to the Project Censored audience, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was a foreign correspondent and bureau chief in the Middle East and the Balkans for 15 years for the New York Times. Hedges previously worked overseas for the Dallas Morning News, the Christian Science Monitor, and NPR. He holds a Master of Divinity from Harvard University, is the author of numerous books, and was a National Book Critics Circle finalist for War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He has also taught at Columbia University, New York University, Princeton University, and the University of Toronto. His new book, forthcoming from Seven Stories Press, titled The Greatest Evil is War. It's been some 20 years since Hedges has written a book about war, and this is a powerful anti-war book that is long overdue, unfortunately. Chris Hedges, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Mickey.
Chris, you took a long hiatus from writing a book about war. Certainly, you've commented on it. You comment on it on your programs, both at RT and now the Real News Network. You address these issues in your writing at Sheer Post. But talk to us about this book, The Greatest Evil is War.
Well, when I finished War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which, to the surprise of myself and the publisher, was a massive bestseller, big commercial publishers came at me to write another book on war, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want to get trapped into this kind of process of diminishing returns. And so I turned down some very lucrative advances and wrote a book called Losing Moses on the Freeway. It was originally called The Decalogue, on how one of the issues of the Ten Commandments, which precede the Old Testament, six of them are lifted directly from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, can dominate, distort, and even destroy lives. But of course, war is something that I'm intimately familiar with, covering the conflict in El Salvador for 5 years, 7 years in the Middle East, and then covering the war in the former Yugoslavia. And so I continued to write on issues of war. At one point, I collected interviews with 50 combat veterans from Iraq on atrocities that they had either witnessed or participated in, with Leila El Arian, and published a book called Collateral Damage, which came out of a long magazine piece, a long investigative piece that we published in The Nation. But yes, you're right. I kind of skirted that issue intentionally, and City Light, Seven Story Press came, especially because I had written some very sharp critiques of NATO and of the expansion of NATO in Eastern and Central Europe. I'd covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. I was there for the collapse of the Soviet Union. I was acutely aware that NATO had been rendered obsolete. NATO was created in 1949 to prevent Soviet expansion into Eastern and Central Europe. It had become redundant. There were promises made to Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany. Everyone, and I find myself in agreement, surprisingly, with Henry Kissinger on this issue, that this was an unnecessary provocation. I mean, George Kennan called it the gravest mistake of the post-Cold War era, the expansion of NATO. So they wanted to put some of these essays together with perhaps past writings, and you're right, that I, for both Truthdig and Sharepost and other places, had written on war, not in book form. And I went back, and in fact, there was quite a large body, surprisingly large body of writing on war that we then put together in this book to examine various facets of war. Those people like Robert Kagan and Victoria Nuland, these kind of neocons, Samantha Power, liberal interventionists who promote war, and then, of course, are lavishly funded by the war industry. Most of these think tanks, the Brookings Institute and everything else, gets a lot of money from the war industry. We had gone out and visited Thomas Young, who was wounded in Iraq and was a paraplegic, and helped him. He couldn't hold a pen while he dictated, write his last letter to Bush and Cheney. There's a long piece about a woman in the Marine Corps who works in the mortuary unit and has to prepare the bodies. And I think that each is a kind of window into the vast enterprise of death that war is. And it helped, of course, that I come out of that environment and understand it.
Indeed. Chris Hedges, we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on in our conversation. You have some riveting, chilling accounts of soldiers' tales and existential crisis, corpses, when bodies come home. You go into great detail and share these first-person accounts of the horrors of war, which make for very powerful storytelling. Important lessons embedded here. You begin the book by saying preemptive war, whether in Iraq or Ukraine, is a war crime. And of course, earlier this year, Russia invaded Ukraine. You, of course, very quickly in the next sentence say it does not matter if the war is launched on the basis of lies and fabrications, as was the case in Iraq, or because of the breaking of a series of agreements with Russia, including the promise by Washington not to extend NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany, not to deploy thousands of NATO troops in Central and Eastern Europe, not to meddle in internal affairs of nations on Russia's border. You go on and on to contextualize this right out of the beginning. So I'm, of course, imagining that what was happening earlier this year, 2022, was some spark for this project.
That was their spark. So that's what triggered the request to put the book together, which, by the way, I initially refused to do for the reasons that I said earlier, and that I was loath to do a kind of pale reflection of war as a force that gives us meaning, which draws on my own personal experiences in war over two decades. But this book is different because it's drawing on the experience of people I interviewed. So there's very little, there is some, but very little in there of my own experience in war. And I think that it's the whole sort of jingoism around the war in Ukraine and the binary view of the world and the demonization of Putin, who, like Saddam Hussein, suddenly becomes the new Hitler, and just the complete naivete or unwillingness to examine what the enterprise of war does. It's going to destroy Ukraine. They're going to have to talk one day. And as Kissinger said, they're going to have to exchange land for peace. But of course, Washington sees this like it did when it supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviets as a way to cripple and perhaps remove Putin from power. But it's a very cynical game because the people who are going to pay are the Ukrainians and, of course, the Russians and their families.
Chris Hedges, I think a chapter very early in the book, very important and something that you've written about at length, riffing on Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky's concept on worthy and unworthy victims and media framing. Could you talk about that and how that's so greatly at play? And of course, how that was a theme in some part on your program at RT America, which was discontinued when the station came off the air.
It's a very important point that we have a very kind of selective morality when it comes to international affairs and war, that we very consciously divide the world into what they call worthy and unworthy victims, those we're allowed to pity, such as Ukrainians, and those such as Palestinians whose suffering is minimized or ignored. So you saw at the height of the Iraq war, with all of the atrocities that were being carried out by Allied forces, primarily NATO and American forces, against Iraqi civilians, but the Palestinians, the Syrians, the Libyans, the Somalis, the Yemenis, the Iraqis, these civilians also deserve our empathy and understanding. And unfortunately, the press amplifies this bifurcation of the world into worthy and unworthy victims. For me, one of the first experiences with this was when I was covering the war in El Salvador in 1984. You had a Catholic Polish priest who was murdered by the regime in Poland, and the Reagan administration and the press used that murder to excoriate the Polish communist government, and yet the Reagan administration had worked to cover up the rape and murder of four Catholic missionaries in El Salvador by the Salvadoran National Guard, even casting aspersions on the women. Jean Kirkpatrick, who was the ambassador of the United Nations, said the nuns weren't just nuns, they were political activists. Secretary of State Alexander Haig speculated that they probably ran a roadblock. And that's a perfect kind of example of what we do to decide who is worthy of empathy, who is worthy of justice, who is worthy of support, and who isn't. And as someone who spent 20 years outside of the United States, this was quite maddening, especially spending much of my time covering the plight of the Palestinians. And the press signs on for the project. So the press is as much to blame as the political leadership.
Edges, in the book, a little later on, and this is getting more to that theme that we touched on earlier, and one that you pointed out that makes this a very different work for you in terms of writing about war, is while it does, of course, have your experiences, your knowledge and analysis, you also have many stories of people at war, in war themselves, including, I'm going to mention a couple folks, but I wondered if you might share a few of the stories or examples that really paint a picture. As you pointed out in the beginning, there are no good wars, none. We mythologize around them, we build stories around them, but there are no good wars. And the stories that you have in the book really show that. You talk about Spencer Rapone and his connection with Pat Tillman, or inspiration from Pat Tillman. You also talk about Robert Weilbacher. Could you talk a little bit about some of the stories of these soldiers that you put in the book?
You know, one of the most poignant is Thomas Young, who I went out to visit in Kansas City. He had become a paraplegic at that point and was on a feeding tube and had decided to disconnect the feeding tube and die. And before he was going to disconnect the feeding tube, he wanted to write a last letter to George Bush and Dick Cheney and all of these people who prosecuted the war. And he couldn't hold a pen. He was 34 years old. And so I had to hold the pen for him as he dictated this very poignant letter, which is in the book and did at this time receive, in fact, it received so much notoriety that he decided not to disconnect the feeding tube. And Tom Morello and others sort of rallied to support. I think Tom Morello actually did a concert and had him come out in his wheelchair. He didn't live that much longer. But just describing what his life was like, he was taking 30 pills a day, suffering from blood clots, caused eventually a pulmonary embolism, and he went into a coma, and his speech was slurred. He didn't have any upper body mobility, didn't have any short-term memory, had terrible pains in his abdomen. They removed his colon. He was fitted with a colonoscopy bag. It was, you know, just a window, and these people are just discarded. They're out of sight and out of view. And then, of course, some of the other people you mentioned are Spencer Rapone was a West Point graduate, and he had been a Ranger. He'd actually been in the Rangers before he went to West Point and served in Afghanistan. Death is so centric to war, which the Greeks understood. And as a Ranger, you have to pick a Ranger in the sky, some Ranger who has been killed in combat, and the instructor's saying you can't pick Pat Tillman, or you don't if you're very smart, which led Spencer to begin to read about Pat Tillman. This was the NFL football player who volunteered to go into the Rangers and was killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan, and they fictionalized his death, which often happens. Jessica Lynch was the same. They invent these mythical, heroic narratives for the public that bear no reality to what actually took place. And he stood up, both inside the academy and then when he graduated and was eventually pushed out of the military, especially for supporting Colin Kaepernick at that time. So these are people of conscience, people who have understood the system and tried to stand up against it.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges. We're discussing his latest book, The Greatest Evil is War. We'll continue our conversation with Chris Hedges after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program, in this segment, we are joined by Chris Hedges. He is author of many books, including Death of the Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was a foreign correspondent and bureau chief in the Middle East and the Balkans for 15 years for the New York Times. He also was a National Book Critics Circle finalist for War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. 20 years later, Chris Hedges has now written The Greatest Evil is War, which will be out soon from Seven Stories Press. And we're talking about the nature of this book and the evils of war today on the program. Chris Hedges, you were just talking a little bit about some of the soldiers that you had talked to or that you were telling those stories. You mentioned another Robert Weilbacher. Are there another couple people or another person that you'd like to bring forward? I think that these are really important parts of your book, as you mentioned earlier, that these people are telling the stories and you're basically sort of a conduit for people to really see the horrors of war.
Robert went on to apply for CO, conscientious objectors, which they make it easy once you're active duty. Jess Goodell is another one. She was the Marine who worked in the mortuary affairs unit in Iraq. So she collected the bodies and the body parts of Marines. And just that those details of what it's like when the body comes in. You have to go through the pockets. You find the notes. You find the pictures of their family. And most of the people who were killed carried lists, things they wanted to do when they got home, food they wanted to eat, pictures, of course, of their wife, kids, family, mothers, fathers, and they're young, as young as 18 years old. And they also had to deal with suicide because hazing is rife within elite units. That's something Spencer went through in the Rangers, but it's very prevalent in the Marines. I spent 3 months with the U.S. Marine Corps. I went into Iraq with 1st Battalion, 1st Marines. And hazing, which is always part of the military culture, is more pronounced in a combat zone, partly because there's no oversight. And it can be very brutal. You can be, this is Marine Corps language, quote-unquote bitch for a day, where they treat you with contempt and make you do all sorts of ridiculous things, like carry bricks from one side to the enclosure to the other, and tease people. These are people who just perhaps don't fit in, or at least in the eyes of the dominant group doesn't fit in. And one of the things she had to do, they would often go to the porta potties and put the barrel of their automatic weapon under their chin and blow their brains out. And the mortuary unit, they'd have to go and scrape the body parts off the walls of the porta potty and send them home. So again, that's a kind of another window into military culture and military life.
Chris Hedges, you also, of course, invoke history as a great teacher, and of course, past often is prologue. You talk about the myths around war, and particularly you dissect some of the more poignant myths about the United States' own civil war, and you talk even about World War II. Those are two significant conflicts in U.S. history that are often lionized and draped in valor and principles and so forth. Can you talk about the propaganda and weaponization of history in that regard?
That's always done. It's even done in Homer. So Homer will look back to the golden age of heroes. And then, of course, Homer became mythologized. Alexander the Great used to reportedly carry a copy of the Iliad. Actually, when I was captured in Iraq, I was captured by the Iraqi Republican Guard in the Basra uprising. I had a copy of the Iliad in my pocket because it is one of the truly great books on war. And we do the same with World War II, with the Civil War. And so in this particular essay, I talk about Gettysburg. I'm descended from three brothers who fought at Gettysburg, one of whom was a Union general, one of whom was a colonel in the elite Iron Brigade, and then my great-great-grandfather, David Edwards, who was a sergeant in the 5th Maine, eventually wounded at Battle of the Wilderness, and just what the reality of Gettysburg was like. And I have my great-great-grandfather's diaries and letters, which explain the savagery of that war. I mean, over 50,000 soldiers were killed or wounded in Gettysburg, and they died in terrible agony. The hospitals were improvised, unsanitary. In fact, when my great-great-grandfather is wounded, he has to walk for 2 or 3 days back to the hospital. He was shot in the shoulder, but he was mobile. But he passes all sorts of people who are just dying, like World War I, just dying where they were left. So it's a way to kind of attempt to puncture that myth. And I mention at the end of that my uncle was in the South Pacific in World War II and came back, he was wounded, came back a physical and emotional wreck, drank himself to death. And I tie my grandmother into it. So my grandmother was 8 years old when they buried her grandfather, who had fought in the Civil War, and that wound dominated the rest of his life. And then her own son was destroyed by World War II.
Chris Hedges, you incorporate so many of these rich stories into the text of The Greatest Evil is War. It's not subtle in its approach. Your message is very clear that war is a horrible, horrible thing, yet it's all around us. And you write toward the end of the book, you have a whole chapter on the permanent war. And of course, you go back and look, whether it's through Orwell or other literary folks, you write about how these themes just persist in our culture. Even though we have critics, we have people that have analyzed this and tried to call this out. You talk about Seymour Melman's Pentagon Capitalism, The Political Economy of War. You mentioned the great book, often forgotten, J. William Fulbright, The Pentagon Propaganda Machine That Shapes Public Opinion. I mean, the permanent war machine is what requires the grist of bodies to perpetuate this kind of transnational corporate capitalism and raping of the planet's resources and destruction of the global population. So this is an entire military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower warned us in his farewell address in 1961. It's become quite monstrous in the last 60-some years, Chris Hedges. Could you talk a little bit about this monstrous machine of war and perhaps talk about what can we do to change it, to stop it, to shut it down?
Well, yes, it's late empire. Toynbee writes about this, are usually destroyed by unchecked militarism. It consumes half of all discretionary spending. It's a bedrock of the American economy. It dominates foreign policy in terms of our response to the rest of the world. The architects of permanent war have thrust us from one military debacle starting in Vietnam, the 20 years in the Middle East, into the next with no accountability, and it's distorted and destroyed the economy, it's militarized the society, and you can't critique it. It seized control of the centers of information, both in Hollywood and in the news industry, and this kind of standardization, uniformity of public discourse around war essentially creates a situation where there's no check on this, what is this disemboweling of the country. It's also militarized our society, so that, quoting Thucydides, the tyranny that Athens imposed on others it finally imposed on itself. But all of the mechanisms, militarized drones, wholesale surveillance, militarized police departments, the largest prison system in the world. Remember that those people in Abu Ghraib who went there and carried out these acts of torture had been carrying out acts of torture within the U.S. prison system. So it's Alexander Berkman in the beginning of World War I called the German military the enemy from within. And that's precisely what it is. How do we stop it? Well, neither of the two ruling parties have any intent of standing up to the war machine, which has become a state within a state. $813 billion for fiscal year 2023. That's more than the next 9 countries, including China and Russia, combined. It's devastating the economy because it monopolizes capital. U.S. debt is over $30 trillion, $6 trillion more than the U.S. GDP. And servicing the debt costs $300 billion a year. This is completely unsustainable. So this is the cancer within the body politic, is, you know, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, not only in terms of its economic impact, but in terms of its moral and political impact.
Chris Hedges, your book, The Greatest Evil is War, is out September 13th, and you can, of course, get a copy of it online at Seven Stories site or at your favorite independent bookstore. Chris Hedges, as always, it's an honor to talk to you. Your latest book, The Greatest Evil is War, is a must-read to stop the permanent war culture in which we live. Thank you for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thanks, Mickey.
And that was my conversation with Chris Hedges about his new book, The Greatest Evil is War. Up next in the Project Censored Show, we're joined by Professor of History at American University, Peter Kuznick. He'll talk about the legacy of Mikhail Gorbachev and failed attempts at world peace. Stay tuned.
You don't give money to the bums on the corner with a sign bleeding from their gums. Talking about you don't support a crackhead. What you think happens to the money from your taxes? The government's the addict with $1 billion a week, kill brown people habit. And even if you ain't on the front line, when massa yell crunch time, you right back at it. Man, look at how you hustling backwards. At the end of the year, add up what they subtracted. 3 out of 12 months, your salary pay for that madness. Man, that's sad.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today, in this second segment of the program, we are delighted and honored to welcome back esteemed historian Peter Kuznick. He is professor of history and director of the award-winning Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. And he is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States, that had an updated edition in 2019 with an additional 200 pages on the Obama years and moving closer up to the present. And again, that's a riveting New York Times bestseller, The Untold History of the United States. And Peter Kuznick is kind enough to take time out of his extraordinarily busy schedule to join us on the Project Censored Show a couple times a year. Always erudite, always important things to say, because history matters, and it matters in the present. And few people can connect those dots better than Professor Peter Kuznick. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mickey. It's always great to be with you.
So, Peter, the occasion today, there's so many things to talk about. Certainly the ongoing war with Russia and Ukraine and NATO. But there's something else has happened recently, and it's not just the death of the Queen that has tabloids everywhere filling their pages. It's actually arguably a more significant change and a shift, and that is sort of marks the ending of an era in many ways. And that's the death of former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. So, Peter Kuznick, could you talk to us in historical context about the significance of Gorbachev's legacy, his passing, and maybe compare contrast some things from the Cold War to the present? Peter Kuznick.
Sure, Mickey. It's interesting you mentioned the Queen. When Gorbachev died, he got a couple hours of very concentrated analysis on mainstream media. You turn on CNN or MSNBC, and they actually did that first day. Spend a little bit of time, because they celebrated the end of the Cold War, that the United States had won the Cold War, and that Gorbachev was largely responsible for that. I don't know if you've been watching mainstream media the last 6 days, but it is wall-to-wall Queen Elizabeth. That is all you see, even 6 days out. It's just nonstop. It's appalling. I thought we actually liberated ourselves from the Brits a couple hundred years ago. I don't know how, you know, but the disproportion, it's not our topic today, but I did see a really brilliant critique by Ali Velshi on MSNBC. And Ali was born in Kenya, and it was a terrific critique of the British Empire and of colonialism and of the bloody history that even under Elizabeth, even when she was queen, continued. They didn't allow those colonies to peacefully become liberated. This was a very, very brutal, vicious, exploitive, bloody history that's been ignored with this whitewash, this pomp and circumstance, this ceremony, and men running around in dresses and all the stuff that's going on over there. It's quite a spectacle. But Gorbachev, who deserved a lot more attention, you know, it was a one-day story, and it was a huge loss to humanity. I go back to the New York Times editorial, May 21st, 1989, and the Times said, imagine that an alien spaceship approached the Earth and sent the message, take me to your leader. Who would that be? Without doubt, Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev. There was no question that it would have been Gorbachev in 1989. And we're not talking about the military leader. We're talking about the moral leader. We're talking about the visionary, somebody who spoke for the planet. Imagine if that same spaceship landed today and said, take me to your leader. You know,
Peter.
It's rogues gallery. So Biden wants to make America great again. Putin wants to make Russia great again. Xi wants to make China great again. Modi wants to make India great again. Truss, I don't know what she's up to. But who would you choose? Pope Francis, maybe in a moral sense. Guterres, maybe. You know, people who at least try to speak for the planet. But there is nobody of the stature and brilliance and vision and decency of Gorbachev on the scene today. And he's exactly what we need. Somebody who transcends narrow nationalism, parochialism, militarism, censorship. You know, it's such a towering figure and such a tragedy that he, not only that he didn't succeed, but also a tragedy that he's viewed so negatively inside of Russia. You know, he's reviled inside Russia. When I would go there during several years, when I made seven trips to Russia, on the one hand, they had nothing positive to say about Gorbachev. And on the other hand, a lot of people had positive things to say about Stalin. You know, in fact, it was Gorbachev who wanted to create a museum on the history of Stalinist terror inside Russia. He tried that in 2008, tried to organize that. He went through all those thousands of pages of records about Stalinist torture and horrors and just the nightmare of Stalinism and hated that and understood that and was committed to making the Soviet Union into an entirely different kind of country. But he was up against a lot. He was up against more than he realized, more than he reckoned with, and more than he was able to overcome. But on the global stage, there was nobody who compared to Gorbachev.
Let's remind our listeners, coming out of the Reagan years and George Herbert Walker Bush and the momentous fall of the Berlin Wall, all of that rich part of the history. And then, of course, many conservative historians in the U.S. were talking about the end of history. Right. And this is what gives birth to the Project for New American Century and the neoconservative movement and the sort of struggle within the American political culture over what to do to fill that void. And then the Clintons came in. Can you remind our listeners a little bit of that history and the role Gorbachev played there until the U.S. under Clinton meddled in Russian political affairs to boost the really weak signal of Boris Yeltsin?
Gorbachev introduced major reforms into the Soviet Union. He took power at age 54 in March of 1985. You had three octogenarian leaders. You had Brezhnev, Chernenko, and Andropov, who had died within a couple years of each other, three Soviet leaders. Brezhnev had been in there by far the longest, and Gorbachev took over. He was much, much younger than anybody else. He was born in 1931 to a family, ironically, that was half Ukrainian and half Russian. He could not begin to conceive the hostility, the enmity, the hatred between Russians and Ukrainians today. And he grew up to a peasant family. He was very much a product of the Soviet system. He worked on the farms, driving combines. Then he went to Moscow State University, the best university in Russia, studied law, met Raisa there, his beloved wife, and worked his way up through the party. And in, by 1985, he'd been involved in agriculture, like Henry Wallace. And by 1985, he was very pro-growth and understood agriculture, industry, production, peaceful production, the centrality of food, and became the chair of the Communist Party inside the Soviet Union. And right from the beginning, he had a vision. It was right from the beginning in 1985 that he began to talk about pulling the Soviet troops out of Afghanistan. That doesn't happen until 1989, but Gorbachev wanted to do it much, much earlier, and he asked the U.S. for help, and the U.S. did everything they could to prevent him from pulling the Soviet troops out of Afghanistan. As he said to Schultz, you keep on putting spikes in the spokes here as we're trying to get the troops out by making it that much harder for us. So they finally get them out in 1989, but he wanted to get them out in 1985 and 1986. But also in 1985, on March 24th, right, within weeks of taking office, he writes the first of a series of extraordinary letters to Reagan. And as you know, and we've discussed, Reagan was the arch Cold Warrior. Reagan came to office wanting to defeat the Soviets. He said, the only answer is we win and you lose. And he called the Soviet Union the evil empire. And he drastically, vastly increased America's military spending and our nuclear programs. And he joked about nuclear war with the Soviet Union.
In an interview he was giving, he made a comment that the bombing will begin in 5 minutes. And, of course, everybody freaked out. He thought it was funny.
Well, he didn't know he was being recorded. But the Europeans especially were horrified. But Gorbachev writes him a letter, March 24th, 1985. Our countries are different by their social systems, by the ideologies in them, but we believe that this should not be a reason for animosity. Each social system has a right to life, and it should prove its advantages not by force, not by military means, but on the path of peaceful competition with the other system. And all people have the right to go the way they have chosen themselves without anybody imposing his will on them from outside. He soon thereafter says, that we must proceed from the objective that we all live on the same planet and must learn to live together. So you could take that from Henry Wallace. You could take that from John Kennedy's AU commencement address in 1963, the same idea that we share this small planet and how are we going to live together? How are we going to make it safe for diversity, as Kennedy said? But his big concern from the beginning was Reagan's Star Wars program. And he knew that Star Wars would be totally ineffective against a Soviet launch. If the Soviets struck the United States, then Star Wars, with all the decoys and all the missiles, Star Wars would be totally ineffective. Star Wars, he feared, could only be effective if the United States attacks the Soviet Union first. And then if the Soviets have a few missiles that survive, Star Wars could possibly take down that handful of missiles that survive, but would be totally ineffectual for any other purpose. He goes on and he meets with Reagan in Geneva in November of that year. So their first meeting together, and they still, you know, hadn't figured things out. They were still somewhat hostile, but they exchanged friendly toasts and they began the beginning of a friendly, potential for a friendly relationship. But Gorbachev had this vision, which he starts to make his peace offensive beginning in January of 1986. And he writes to Reagan and he offers this bold program for complete liquidation of nuclear weapons throughout the world before the end of the present century. Nobody talked like that, really. So he called for working together to eliminate nuclear weapons before the end of the last century. And he talks about getting rid of all U.S. and Soviet intermediate-range ballistic missiles in Europe, ending nuclear testing, reducing strategic weapons, changing the ABM treaty to allow the U.S. to continue research on SDI, but banning deployment for 15 years. And he goes on, you know, with one proposal after another, he unilaterally stops nuclear testing. But then in April, the Chernobyl accident occurs. And that really terrified him because he understood that Chernobyl, which created such havoc all over Europe was one third the size of the smallest nuclear weapon. So what would happen if there were actual nuclear war? People have forgotten in this country what nuclear war is, what nuclear weapons do. You know, that's very, very dangerous that we've forgotten. And then he goes to Iceland in October of 1986, meets with Reagan at Reykjavik, and comes with a mind-blowing set of proposals. And he starts to lay them out for drastic reductions in nuclear armaments, solving all the crises around the world. And Reagan, of course, is caught off guard. And he always, you know, the story about Reagan, he would never meet with anybody without his 3x5 file cards. Even with people he knew, people in his cabinet, they'd always give him the file cards to read from. Then there are these crazy stories about the time when the three auto execs came to see him before a trip overseas. And Reagan starts reading from his file cards, and they're getting chagrined, and they're looking down at the ground because they realize he's got the wrong file cards. They have nothing to do with these people, what they're there for. But that was Reagan. But Reagan gets so flustered, he can't find the answers in his file cards. He starts to drop them on the floor. And, you know, he doesn't know what to say in response. And then Gorbachev talks about, goes on further, doubles down on it, about getting rid of, he says, we should get rid of all offensive strategic nuclear arms. We'll cut them in half. Basically, he says, we'll cut 50% in the next 5 years and get rid of the other 50% in the 5 years after that, plus this whole series of ideas. But we have to deal with the Star Wars issue. And Reagan says, he's not going to give up Star Wars. He says, but I'll share it with you. And Jack Matlock, the former ambassador to Russia, the sane one, writes down Gorbachev's response. He says, Gorbachev finally exploded. Excuse me, Mr. President, he said, his voice rising, but I cannot take your idea of sharing SDI seriously. You are not willing to share with us oil well equipment, digitally guided machine tools, or even milking machines. Sharing SDI would provoke a second American Revolution. Let's be realistic and pragmatic. And so then we had the American and the Soviet negotiators go back and forth, and they refuse to let go of things. And Gorbachev says, let's go home. We've accomplished nothing. But then Schultz and Shevardnadze met over lunch to see if they could resolve the differences. And Gorbachev, again, proposed even better terms. And it looked like Schultz says, let's do it. Paul Nitzer, the arch Cold Warrior, said, this is the best deal we've been offered in 25 years. Let's take it. And Reagan turns to Richard Perle. And Richard Perle says, well, it will kill Star Wars. But we came within one word, because what Gorbachev said, if you will limit Star Wars to the laboratory for 10 years, we will eliminate all nuclear weapons. And as Richard Rose, I don't always agree with Richard Rose, but he wrote intelligently, and he said that Star Wars represented little more than a specious concern for testing outside the laboratory systems, something that had hardly yet even entered the laboratory in 1986. And it was based on that we're still threatened with nuclear annihilation. And Gorbachev was so frustrated afterwards. So he and Reagan are leaving the building, and Gorbachev described the scene. He said, it was already dusk. The mood was downcast. Reagan reproached me. You planned from the beginning to come here and put me in this position. No, Mr. President, I replied. I'm prepared to go back inside right now and sign the document concerning the issues we already agreed upon if you will refrain from plans to militarize space. Reagan says, I'm extremely sorry. And Gorbachev then briefs the Politburo, and he says that Reagan exhibited extreme primitivism, a caveman outlook, and intellectual impotence. But he says that Reagan believed he could exhaust us economically via an arms race, create obstacles for the Soviet leadership, and effectively, you know, bring down the Soviets with this military spending. It was tragic because Gorbachev hoped to go back and renegotiate some of this, but that's when the Iran-Contra scandal hit. And the Reagan was immobilized for the rest of his presidency.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with esteemed historian Peter Kuznick from American University, talking about the legacy of Gorbachev, the Cold War, and we're going to continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
We got to work for peace. Peace ain't coming this way. If we only work for peace, if everyone believed in peace the way they say they do, we'd have peace. The only thing wrong with peace is that you can't make no money from it. The military and the monetary, they get together whenever they think it's necessary. They've turned our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet into a cemetery.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the show, in this segment, we are delighted to bring back to the show Professor Peter Kuznick from American University. We are talking about the recent passing of Gorbachev, former leader of the USSR, and well, we're really talking about war and peace, and we're talking about failed opportunities to create lasting peace. And Peter Kuznick, as an historian, historiographically, I know this is unpopular, but it seems that it's coming more and more to light, in part because of some of your important work. Reagan basically prolonged the Cold War.
The late Reagan was not nearly as bad as the earlier Reagan. I mean, it was really the earlier part of Reagan's presidency that he did the worst things in Central America and Afghanistan. And then as if this is, has this epiphany that for some reason the Soviets believe his bellicosity. He says it's kind of struck him out of the blue that he was shocked to discover that the Soviets took him seriously. He really was affected by watching the day after and became very depressed and wouldn't talk to people for days.
The film about nuclear winter, right?
Second most watched television program of all time, started all these debates in the United States in 1983. And there were several other great films like that coming out at the time. And Reagan was taken aback by that. And I think he does begin to have a little bit of a change of heart after that and is at least more open to dealing with Gorbachev. If not honestly, at least somewhat receptive to these initiatives. But meanwhile, there are dynamics inside the Soviet Union. Gorbachev starts his program of perestroika. Perestroika called for restructuring the Soviet economy. And he combines that with glasnost, which means openness, transparency. So the closed Soviet system is going to be waken up and opened up by Gorbachev, and he's going to reform it economically. He's also going to reform it democratically. He was totally a democratic socialist. He stops the press censorship, releases the political prisoners, opens the Soviet Union up to the world. He believes in the Soviet system very, very personally and sincerely. What he understood was that the Soviet economy was being strangled by military spending. Now, we don't know the exact figures, and he couldn't even get the exact figures, but we assume that 25% of GDP probably went to military spending. And much of this was worthless. In the 70s, they produced thousands more tanks than the United States. They were just wasting money on this military welfare state that they had created that has momentum of its own. And Gorbachev knew that he had to dismantle it. And he knew he had to make deeper reforms. The problem was that 1985, 1986, oil prices plummeted. And so Gorbachev was trying to make structural reforms in the Soviet economy at the time when their main source of income was eroding. So, I mean, the timing just didn't work. And these were expensive reforms that he was trying to make. But he did democratize, and he did allow for democracy inside the Soviet Union. And they had presidential elections, and they had parliamentary elections, and they were free elections for the first time in Soviet or Russian history. He made changes. And not only that, there was a flourishing of the arts and the humanities and the movies and music and painting and literature. You know, that Russian culture that we all love was now let loose again during this time. So it was almost the time of Camelot, right? And, you know, it's funny to think if John Kennedy, the last year of John Kennedy, had been president at the same time that Gorbachev was in power, the world would have seen a utopian era unmatched in history. So 1988, 1989, what Putin says is that the economic reform had to precede the political reform, and that Gorbachev had it backwards. So you've got this political openness, and now they're seeing these images of the West and the higher standards of living, and people start to rebel. And first the Baltic states in 88 talk about the need for sovereignty. And then in 1989, they start the claims for independence. And then the former Warsaw Pact nations start to demand independence also. And where initially Gorbachev did send the troops into Lithuania and Latvia, but once the Warsaw Pact nations started to declare independence, he did not send the troops in. And so that was totally bloodless. And November of 1989, the Berlin Wall falls. And effectually, there's a coup inside the Soviet Union. And eventually, Gorbachev relinquishes power. And we have go in from there into a terrible period of Soviet history when the economy collapses, with Western economic advisors from Harvard and Columbia put the Soviet economy through shock therapy and leads to gangster capitalism. And they go through a period in the early 1990s where life expectancy plummets from 66 years down to 57 years, where unemployment skyrockets, where agriculture is destroyed, where a lot of the industry stops, and this Russian economy, the mighty Russian economy, shrinks to the size of Holland's. So it was really a horrible period under Yeltsin after Gorbachev relinquished his power. But the fact that he did it peacefully, and the fact that he understood that if he intervened to try to stop this process, it would mean undermining his whole philosophy of democracy, of glasnost, of perestroika, of allowing people to make their own decisions about what they wanted to be. You know, and he was a democratic socialist. He wanted to maintain the Soviet Union in a democratic form. But by that point, the forces were just out of control.
And then, of course, you get through Yeltsin. And then, of course, there's the rise of Vladimir Putin in particular. And of course, that's a different direction. Could you talk to our audience a little bit about some of Gorbachev's assessment, how much Gorbachev spoke about what was happening since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or even during the Obama years, what was happening with the U.S. and Ukraine with Victoria Nuland and others and the coup there? Can you talk to us a little bit about this later in life Gorbachev?
Later in life, Gorbachev wins the Nobel Peace Prize in 1990. He donates much of the money of that to Novaya Gazeta, which was edited by Dmitry Muratov, who won the Nobel Peace Prize last year as an independent journalist effort inside of Russia. He has this league of former Nobel laureates that he creates the Gorbachev Foundation, becomes a voice for international peace and a voice for global democracy. He supported, interestingly, Putin's seizure of Crimea in 2014. Crimea, as you know, had always been part of Russia. And in 1954, Nikita Khrushchev, in some mental lapse, decides to give it to Ukraine as a gift. But that's where the Soviet fleet was based, in Sevastopol. And so when the coup starts in 2014, the Russians take it back, and Crimeans want to be part of Russia, not part of Ukraine under the people who took power in 2014 in the coup. So Gorbachev supported Russian efforts in Crimea. He did not speak out against the invasion of Ukraine, but I think it's clear that he was strongly opposed to it, not only because his family was half Ukrainian, but because basically what Putin has done is he's dismantled every part of the Gorbachev legacy. Because Putin has not only waged a war aggressively against another country, against all of Gorbachev's values and everything he believed in, but he's also reimposed harsh conditions inside of Russia. Censorship, preventing dissent, stopping freedom of speech, all of the things that Gorbachev envisioned as part of a modern Russia, Putin now has destroyed, which is part of the tragedy of what we're facing now and part of the tragedy of Gorbachev's life. As the one man on the global scene who had this vision for the planet that would have been based on peace and prosperity and democracy and openness and encouraging dissent and debate and freedom, we've gone back into the craziest, most dangerous world. And Gorbachev's big effort to get rid of nuclear weapons, we're closer to nuclear war now than we've ever been, really, at least the last 60 years. And this was Gorbachev's nightmare. Gorbachev did more to try to eliminate nuclear weapons than any other leader ever has, did more to try to change the nature of the global security architecture than any other leader, and peacefully oversaw the withdrawal of troops. But part of the problem is that in 1990, when Gorbachev gave his assent to the unification of Germany, and he was promised, among those who promised him that NATO would not expand to the east were Baker, George H.W. Bush, Genscher, Kohl, Gates, Mitterrand, Thatcher, Hurd, Majors, and Werner. I mean, they all gave assurances that NATO would not expand. And NATO was holding meetings to talk about expansion before 1990 was even up. They didn't begin the actual expansion until 97 and enforce it and really put into effect in Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Poland in 1999. But again, they betrayed Gorbachev's vision. And that's what Putin made such a big issue of, the expansion of NATO to Ukraine and Georgia, which he opposed adamantly in 2008. And opposed it again in 2021. Was that the only thing that motivated him? No, he's got this crazy vision of reestablishing the old Soviet empire somehow, the Russian empire. I don't know what's going on in Putin's head, but again, is the opposite of everything that Gorbachev stood for.
Well, Peter Kuznick, as Chris Hedges remarked earlier in the program, his latest book is The Greatest Evil is War, and he starts by talking about the great criminality of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, only to then quickly go back and talk about the NATO encroachment and encircling, only to go back and mention the equally criminal assault on Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11. We're 21 years beyond the events of September 11th, and the carnage and the destruction of those wars is nearly incalculable.
Go back to Vietnam. As you know, when Robert McNamara came to my class, he said he accepts that 3.8 million Vietnamese died. The number is mind-boggling.
Well, Peter Kuznick, I want to thank you so much for sharing a lot of this untold history about Gorbachev's legacy in the Cold War. And I want to thank you, too, for your tireless efforts to work for a greater and broader peace movement. It's a delight to have both you and Chris Hedges on the same program with very overlapping themes and important messages that we really have to get serious, the human race, about ending all wars and conflicts.
Well, thank you, Mickey. Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear this.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program. Also the host, Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
My conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa this Friday, September 23rd at 3 p.m. I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'll talk to Maria Hinojosa about the adaptation for young readers of her memoir, Once I Was You, Finding My Voice and Passing the Mic. Maria Hinojosa is host of Latino USA, distributed by NPR for 27 years, and by PRX since 2020. On the occasion of Latino History Month, I'll talk to her about Latino culture and politics, and we'll open the phone lines. Tune in to my exclusive interview with Maria Hinojosa, Friday, September 23rd at 3 p.m. See you then.
Este canto.